Fescue toxicity, the use of volunteer corn for silage, and also taking a look at the forage newsletter will be the topics covered in this week's edition of the Extension Service Update. I'm Curtis Dame, Hopkins County Extension Agent for Agriculture and Natural Resources, and thanks for tuning in this week. Looking ahead, tall fescue, which has grown on more than 35 million acres, is the most important cultivated pasture grass in the United States. Often used on lawns and other recreational areas since the 1930s, this cool season perennial grass has been widely planted in the area from the lower Midwest to eastern Oklahoma and central Georgia. Its rapid acceptance was due to many attributes that we still somewhat enjoy today, which includes the ease of establishment, long grazing season, tolerance to environmental stresses, and pest resistance. With that said, over 8 million beef cows are maintained on tall fescue pastures, and over 700,000 horses graze pastures that contain substantial populations of this grass. Now, chemical measures of forage nutritive values, such as digestible dry matter, crude protein, and mineral levels, suggest that tall fescue forage has potential for producing high-quality, nutritious forage that should and can result in good animal performance. In spite of all this, though, tall fescue gained a reputation for poor gains and reproduction problems in cattle and horses alike. Mares grazing tall fescue would often abort, produce dead foals, and have foaling difficulties, or fail to even produce milk at all. Now, this syndrome and problem we're discussing is called fescue toxicosis, and the syndromes in cattle include many different types. Those include fescue foot, bovine fat necrosis, fescue toxicity or summer slump, and overall negative animal responses. Now, fescue toxicity syndrome in horses causes serious reproductive problems with mares, and most horse owners here in the county realize that, and when searching for hay in other pastures, tend to avoid especially Kentucky 31 infected endophyte fescue. The cause of the fescue toxicity, on the other hand, and for many years, was due to alkaloids that occur in tall fescue, which were suspected to cause the syndrome, but this was never proven. In 1977, several scientists at the USDA Russell Research Center in Athens, Georgia, reported a fungus inside the grass that was suspected to be associated with the syndrome. This was confirmed in grazing trials both in Alabama, where excellent animal gains and no evidence of the toxicity were obtained on fungus-free, or what we now refer to as endophyte-free, tall fescue. Now, the fungus associated with the toxicity is an endophyte, which means that it lives within the plant itself. This fungal endophyte produces ergo-alkaloids that can be highly toxic to livestock. You see this toxicity in animal responses. Beef steer daily gains on endophyte-free tall fescue are typically 50 to 100% more than on grass with high rates of toxic endophyte infestation. Steer daily gains are typically 1.5 to 2 pounds per day on endophyte-free grass compared to around 1 pound or less on highly infected grass. Steers on endophyte-free grass are tolerant of both heat, graze throughout the day, shed their winter hair coats in the spring, and are more active than steers on the toxic endophyte infected grass. In addition, this week we wanted to take a look at the forage news. The newsletter addresses changes to the Farm Service Agency acreage reporting dates for 2017. USDA FSA announced that producers who file accurate and timely reports for all crops and land uses, including failed acreage, can prevent the potential loss of FSA program benefits. The acreage reporting deadline has changed, and the 2017 crop reports for hay and pasture must be done this fall, and that is a contrast from previous years. The deadlines are listed here. November 15, 2016, producers need to have reported the perennial forage acres including alfalfa, grass, mixed forages, and clovers. Now move on to next month after that, December 15, 2016, any fall seeded small grains including barley, oats, rye, and wheat must also be reported. Now, all other crops for the 2017 year will be reported by July 15th. Lastly, this week, I wanted to take a look at nutrient removal regarding harvesting volunteer corn this fall. Now, every corn and plant does require nutrients in order to grow. These credits are not free, and so when you harvest silage here in the county, you are losing some nutrient value to the land from which this crop or material was harvested. Data indicates there's a considerable amount of potassium in the non-grain part of the corn plant. These nutrient concentrations are expressed on a dry matter basis, so adjustment downward is needed to account for stover moisture content also. Calculating P and K removal in harvested stover is somewhat complicated, as nutrients can be leached, especially potassium from leaves and corn stalks with rainfall after grain harvest. But we do know that we haven't had that much rain since corn harvest started, therefore a lot of nutrients are still retained in the plant matter itself. The next question that follows is, what is that corn stover worth, and what should those that rent ground charge for it? Corn stover is made up of stalks, leaves, husks, and tassels that left in the field after harvesting the grain with a combine. This stover can be used for biofuel production or low-quality emergency livestock feed. At the end of the day, you have to ask yourself as both a producer and a landowner if $42 per acre is worth the cost of the low-quality feed in some instances. Now, this year we have a lot of volunteer corn, and the quality of this type of feed will go up. But as said before, the average cost for potassium and phosphorus removal is equivalent to roughly $40 per acre based on 3 tons per acre of matter removed at this rate. If you have any questions about this topic or the other topics discussed this week, give your local extension service a call.